This is George Hoffman on November 24th, sitting with Professor Robert Swain for the Oral History Project, and we're discussing Robert Motherwell. Bob, in the Motherwell personnel file, I came across this sheet of paper denoting Motherwell's activities at Hunter 1971 and 72, and the first item says, one, on call to visit classes on request of instructors, for example, Robert Swain, Andy Jansen, Eunice Lipton, so forth. And when I stopped you one day and asked you about this, you said, sure, he would come to talk with me. So I wondered whether you could give us a little bit of fill us in about your encounters with him.
Well, it was kind of interesting. I was kind of amazed that, I think it was Goosen said that Motherwell was going to come and be an honorary professor for a year. And Goosen said that he would be available to faculty, and he would go into classes and do whatever, talk to them. And I held Motherwell in some quite esteem because I'd heard him speak when I was a student, and he was quite a marvelous speaker. And he had an approach to doing things which sort of reminded me a little bit like Tony Smith, in the sense that he actually gave oral histories of things. And an example of this is that we put together this year, Goosen put together, a discussion about Duchamp. And various people in the faculty were going to speak about Duchamp.
About when, what year do you
this
think?
This was when he was here.
That 71,
yeah, it was
72.
Probably in the fall of 71, I think. Maybe it was in the spring, I don't know. But various people in the faculty were going to speak, and Motherwell was going to speak. And so I remember Bob Morris got up and he read lengthy quotes that Duchamp had made about the avant-garde and discussed sort of some attitudes that Duchamp had. And then Robert Berry got up and showed a slide of one of Duchamp's paintings. It was a coffee grinder. And he spoke at length about the formal and metaphorical ideas inherent in this coffee grinder and Duchamp's philosophy. And then they asked Motherwell to get up, and this is what I always felt was amazing about Motherwell. He got up and he said, I don't know too much about those things which other people had known about Duchamp, but I knew Duchamp quite well. And these are the things I thought about him. And he proceeded to describe Duchamp in a certain way that I don't remember clearly because it was mostly in story form, but it was how Motherwell approached most of the things that I came in contact with him during that year, where he would sit down, and much like Tony Smith, he had the ability to tell the same story very accurately over and over again. So I would invite him to my painting class, and he would come and sit for the whole class, talk about paintings, and talk about his associations with other artists and other art movements and things of that nature. And one thing I felt, which was quite typical of Motherwell, is that he let you know right away that he went to Harvard and he graduated in philosophy. That was very important. I mean, we would meet outside the class and I would say something like, Bob, we're going to go in and these are beginning students. And he said, yes, and he would say, blah, 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 you know, I graduated in philosophy from, not as bragging, but sort of setting the tone for, we're going to do this kind of thing. And I recall that he wrote his, I don't think it was a dissertation because he went to Columbia later when he came back from Europe, but he wrote on Delacroix and the poet, the 19th century poet.
Mallarmé.
No. I want to say Baudrillard, but it's...
Baudelaire,
right. And I found that combination of two people very interesting. Here he writes about Delacroix, who is the romantic who goes off on a trip, which I think is very much like sort of Motherwell. Motherwell is, I think, from the West Coast, grew, born in Washington, grew in California, some of that, goes immediately to Paris, is assimilated into a Paris aesthetic, very much involved in French culture, attitudes, surrealism, travels extensively when he comes back in the United States, makes friends with Mata here in New York, talks about Mata, travels to Mexico with Mata. Very influenced, I think, initially by surrealism. And in the course of talking about all of these things, about the climate of New York at that time, about artists immigrating from Europe at that time, he starts relating these anecdotal stories about how he met people. And the one story I remember, which I absolutely adore, is his story about how he met Jackson Pollock. And apparently Mata was trying to form a group of artists and break away from the dominant ideology of surrealism and form his own ideas about it. And Motherwell somehow had joined up with this group and had gone off to find other artists to participate in it. So Motherwell tells this marvelous story where he goes off to find Pollock. He's never met him before. He's in the village someplace, and he climbs up the stairs in this loft building to find Pollock. And of course, he adds all of these little anecdotal things to it, climbing up, being. He gets to this door finally, and he knocks on the door, and he can't hear anything but loud music. And he knocks on it a little louder, and a man opens the door a little bit and jams his foot in it and looks out at Motherwell and yells at him, "What do you want?" And Motherwell says, "My name's Robert Motherwell, and I'm looking for the artist Jackson Pollock because we're putting together a discussion group to talk about art. And I want to know whether you know where Pollock is and whether he'd be interested in this." And with that, the man on the other side of the door looks at him and says, "No, I'm not interested in discussing art," and slams the door in his face. Now, what's so funny about that is Motherwell describes that as how he met Pollock. To me, that doesn't sound like a meeting at all. But what was fascinating is that he was extremely historically minded. Whenever I talked to him, he had this urgency about him to document these events. And I know that he had written on four or five different publications and started various series on modern artists and
yes.
Parisian Review and things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And in these discussions, both in class and in general discussions, when there would be a panel or something, he would always stress the importance of putting down this information, of writing down what you're doing right now, the oral history of what was happening, to get these events correct. And the other story he told...
And of having students understand them correctly when he was in your classroom.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think there's a very important point that relates to that, and that is when he told these stories, it was in the way that one would tell about humanism and about how things are achieved. In other words, he would talk about, you know, I went out, I tried to get this group together, we put this together, we wrote it down. And so, as you said, it's very insightful for students in the sense that you are generating your own history. To formalize this history gives you credence in terms of understanding your past as prologue and things of that nature.
Yeah.
One of the most upsetting stories he told, which I can't to this day get over, is when Mondrian moved to New York City, apparently Motherwell was a friend of his. And Mondrian didn't have, according to Motherwell, international following. He had a small group of people who knew his work and who followed his work. And Motherwell said that if you wanted to visit him, you went around to, I don't know, he lived in Midtown someplace, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was more of an apartment than I think a mm-hmm. loft building, but mm-hmm. you would go around there, and if there was no note on the door, you'd knock on the door, and if Mondrian was there, he would open the door and he'd say, "Come in." And you could sit and chat with him, and he had a lot of followers. And Motherwell tells a story where one day, which often happened, he went up and there was a little note on the door, and the note said, "Pay me," which meant, "Don't knock, don't bother me, I'm painting." And subsequently, apparently, Mondrian fell ill, put the note on the door, "Don't bother me," had some complication, and died. And I'll never get over that story, because Motherwell tells it with a lot of detail and substance. And all of a sudden, Mondrian's life is over with.
Yeah.
Then he went on to say that when that happened, he went directly to the Museum of Modern Art. And he said, we must save this entire room, all of the artifacts, everything in it, and put it in the Museum of Modern Art as it is. And he said, you're obligated to do this. This is a man of monumental achievement, and we have an opportunity now in history to do this. And I think the whole time that year I was around him, that's what struck me, is that he was obsessively concerned with documenting, with writing down, with getting things organized so people would have access to this information. And among the people that I met around that time, say earlier when Rothko would join our group for lunch or something like that, or even when I lived in Provincetown for a while, I met Hans Hoffman, all of those people, I've never met anybody as intellectually bound or concerned with historical information, both in a literary sense and in a historical sense. And I think the thing in all of these conversations, which was totally amazing to both faculty and students, is whenever he talked, if he talked about Mondrian or Duchamp or Mata or Surrealism, it wasn't as he was talking about historical fact. He was talking about his living history that he went through. This happened to Mondrian, that happened to him, this, that, and that, and the other thing.
So the history was in the people.
Right.
Yeah.
And in the way he would tell stories about
them.
Insofar as students went in teaching, I think it's very valuable because of what I just said, that they understood that these were individual young people making history. He would he talked about his return from Europe in the 30s and finding not much going on, as he said, in the United States, except within a very limited group of people. And he spent a short stint, I think, at Columbia studying with, I forget who the art historian is.
Meyer Shapiro.
Probably,
yeah.
Yes. And then he went on to form these other groups,
yeah,
and very involved with the abstract expressionists.
Yeah.
I found him exceedingly warm and approachable. At no time did he ever seem like a person who couldn't be approached about any type of problem. I remember writing him a letter asking him to come to my undergraduate painting classes, and he wrote me a very nice handwritten letter, and he said, yes, when should I be there, and how long, and what would you like me to do, and so forth and so on. I said, well, you know, when you come, we'll do whatever. But he was very, very approachable, very accommodating. And I think above all, he understood educational problems in students. I mean, he understood that art is very much involved with education, both inside and outside of the institution.
That art is involved in education.
Mm-hmm.
That they were closely aligned in his mind.
Mm-hmm.
Period.
Mm-hmm.
So this would really account for his very early involvement here at Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
He, in many ways, was the ideal person to bring in in education in terms of modern art. If you were going to have someone, he was the man. So I see what you're saying. He personified that. And you say you think it was because he really deeply believed in that.
Oh,
in
absolutely.
That, in that alignment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've never met anybody who was so concerned with documentation and with, in general, education. As you know, he started in Hunter in 1951. I think at some point he became chairman.
No, no.
He did not become chairman.
No, he taught from 51 to 59.
Oh.
So it was a long stretch. Yeah.
But I think what's remarkable about that period of history to teach modern art in the United States is very radical.
I think it, exactly. I think it was radical of Lutz to seek him out, Edna Lutz. I think it was radical for the then college president to accept such a figure. And it was radical to find that combination in an artist,
right.
I think, that sense of history and the sense of, I mean, the thing about education suggests a sense of obligation to future generations or something along that line, or that he himself wanted to be educated and felt that it was a natural state for man. It's very interesting to have this insight because it tells us about him, what he really was. So.
No, it was quite remarkable.
Yeah. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, George.
Okay.